Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back when the words America and modern were practically synonyms, one great reason was the U.S. had abundant connective tissue much of the world sorely lacked. First-class highways, railways, power lines, waterways, dams, phones, telegraphs, lots and lots of gleaming new infrastructure. Well, it's not new anymore. Now, rebuilding infrastructure is front and center in the Obama vision of economic stimulus. But what will we get? This hour On Point, the new push for huge infrastructure spending and what we should be building. You can join the conversation. If we're rebuilding America's infrastructure, where should we start and what should it look like for the 21st century? You cannot turn anywhere in the last week and not hear infrastructure talk, and most of all at the big governor's conference in Philadelphia. Obama was there. Vice President-elect Joe Biden was there. Here he is in his inimitable way, the VP-elect, saying the U.S. needs to get going, that it's being left in the dust by competitors.
China invests between 7 and 9% of their GDP in infrastructure projects. We invest as a nation over the last decade or more, less than 1%. And there's a reason that when you turned on the Olympics to watch them this past summer, you saw a Medlev train going over 200 miles an hour in supposedly a third world country in terms of its economy, blowing into town, dealing with the environmental problems they have, as well as transporting people in a way that we don't even come close to being able to do.
Just Democrats talking infrastructure? No way. Here's California's Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, again at the governor's conference talking turkey.
We have $28 billion alone of projects that are ready to go, literally putting shovels into the dirt within a few months. I mean, America has not done anything when it comes to real serious infrastructure building in the last four decades. I think it's time that we get our act together and do it. This is a good opportunity, not only because it will build infrastructure, but also it creates great jobs and it gets the economy stimulated.
There's Biden, Schwarzenegger, and now we've got Leonhardt. David Leonhardt of the New York Times joins us, economics columnist for the Times, contributor to the paper's Economics with an X blog. David Leonhardt, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
So much talk about infrastructure and economic stimulus. We're going to try and pull it apart. But to talk to us about the tensions here. Clearly, there's a huge need out there at lots of levels for, you know, physical shovel-in-the-dirt stuff, as Arnold was saying, and also for stimulus. But this is not a simple equation, not a simple picture.
No, it's not. And there are really two big tensions. The first is this question of doing it well and doing it quickly. If we went out and knocked down a whole bunch of buildings and then rebuilt them the next day, that would do wonders to stimulate the economy. Mm. We could, in fact, knock down some energy-efficient buildings and construct some energy-inefficient buildings, and it would do wonders for
lots of jobs, lots of paychecks.
Exactly. You could, as one economist said to me, you could dig holes and fill them again.
Right.
But obviously that doesn't do anything to help us long-term. And so the question is, how do we sort through the idea of doing projects that make sense, but also doing them quickly enough so that they will stimulate the economy? We don't need to worry that they need to happen in the next few months. The economy is likely to be weak for, I think, at least 2 years, certainly at least a year, and I think 2 years is much more likely. And so if you get projects that start late in 2009 and go into 2010, that could definitely be part of a good stimulus bill. But you don't really want projects that start in December of 2010. And
just too late to get it going right now when it needs the kind of electroshock.
That's right. It's too late to be of much use in preventing the sort of vicious cycle in which lack of jobs leads to lack of spending, which leads to more job cuts and more spending cuts.
What kind of money are we talking about? I mean, there's an overall stimulus package. Pelosi and Harry Reid are talking about a $500 billion something on Obama's desk by January 20th, Inauguration Day. Obama aides are talking $700 billion. Joe Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, talking $1 trillion. Of course, that's not all infrastructure. What kind of money?
I think most of those numbers, when numbers like that are kicked about, are referring to 2 years. And one handy number to keep in mind is that 1% of GDP is now about $150 billion.
Okay.
So if you took, say, $700 billion and spread it over 2 years, you're talking about $350 billion a year, which is a little more than 2% of GDP a year. And it's possible to imagine having some sizable portion of that, $50 billion, who knows, $100 billion in each year being infrastructure. I don't think it's going to be mostly infrastructure or anywhere close to it.
But if we got up into those numbers, David, where does that put the United States in terms of getting back in the game of building, rebuilding infrastructure where everyone agrees we've lagged for decades now?
Well, that gets to the second tension. So I don't quite agree with the numbers that the vice president-elect used in that little snippet that you played. He said that I think China spends, what, 7% and the U.S. spends less than 1%.
That's what he said.
There are all kinds of different ways to measure these things, and it depends what you include and what you don't include. I think the U.S. is probably spending more in the range of 2%, 3%, 4% of GDP. But it does trail other countries. China's probably not the best comparison because China is a country not nearly as far along in its economic development as the United States.
So it's on a tear, and it needs a hell of a lot of new infrastructure. But maglev trains, he's right. We have nothing like what they've got that way.
That's exactly right. And anyone who goes to Europe or China and then comes home can really see in a very tangible way. You leave these gleaming airports and come home to these bedraggled airports. Tom Friedman of the Times talks about that, about leaving an overseas airport and coming back to JFK.
And it doesn't feel so first world by comparison here sometimes.
It doesn't. And so the real second tension, though, is it's not just a matter of how much we spend. It's also a matter of how we do it. And if you look at the numbers on infrastructure spending as a share of GDP, it fell really rapidly after the 60s and 70s, at the end of this period where we were building the interstate highway system. It fell really rapidly. But since then, it's been rising. Infrastructure spending as a share of GDP is at basically a 25 or 30-year high. In inflation-adjusted dollars, it's risen enormously over the last decade. It's risen a little bit faster than the United States economy has risen. Now, it hasn't risen fast enough. I'm not saying that we are doing enough spending on infrastructure. But the first problem isn't actually the amount of spending. It's the complete lack of rigor in how we spend. And so when we spend these dollars, we don't go around and look at how could we spend this so it would do the most to help the economy? How could we spend this so it would do the most to cut carbon emissions? How could we spend it so it would do the most to cut traffic? And instead, we end up building roads that we don't need. We've all heard of examples like the Bridge to Nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Pork isn't really the biggest problem. It's a problem. But a bigger problem is just that we're not really even trying. We're not, when we go out to decide on these projects, we're not analyzing them from any sort of standpoint of economics or energy the way other countries do. Britain and some of the other countries of Northern Europe really do this much more seriously than we do.
You know, David, you say that kind of casually, but what you're describing there is a kind of travesty. I mean, you've described recently in the Times a sort of system kind of built for boondoggle in a first world country just not paying attention to an overall picture of critical infrastructure. And here we may have one shot at the 21st century because of this confluence of events. And you're saying there's not really a great government structure to make sure it gets done or done anything like right.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, one of my favorite examples is actually sports stadiums. I'm a big sports fan, so I'm not going to say that we shouldn't have nice sports stadiums. Mm. But we spend all this government money subsidizing team owners, and to some extent subsidizing fans, to replace perfectly good stadiums with stadiums that are just a little bit nicer and have more luxury boxes. That is a crazy use of government money relative to investing in ways that might reduce traffic and give people more time at their jobs or more time with their families, or in ways that might reduce carbon emissions and do things to benefit the planet and make us less reliant on oil-producing countries that are pretty virulently anti-American.
Make us competitive and remaining affluent in a whole new century.
Exactly, exactly. And so now Obama has talked about this idea of setting up something called an infrastructure bank.
What would that be?
Well, in and of itself, it doesn't solve the problem, but it actually has the potential to help. So an infrastructure bank would finance infrastructure projects separately from the annual budgets of the government.
So it's a way to end-run Congress and put someone less political in charge?
Well, so that's not inherent in the idea, but the way Obama talks about it, he has suggested it would involve that. And, you know, not a bad model is actually the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a group of experts that Congress has set up. They were an act of Congress. But Congress doesn't control their individual decisions. And I think it would would be ideal to see something similar with infrastructure, in which Congress sets aside the money. I mean, that's who controls the money in this country, Congress and the executive branch, and that's the way it needs to be. They're democratically accountable. But they are then not making the really individual decisions about whether to build a highway in western Pennsylvania that no one's ever going to use, or whether to subsidize a sports stadium that really isn't a particularly good use of money. Instead, what they're going to do is they are going to dedicate the money. And then you are going to have a group of people whose job it is to try to analyze which things actually make sense. And they have to report to the public. Ideally, you would want something that was more open than the Federal Reserve is. And it wouldn't be behind closed doors, but it also wouldn't be subject to the vicissitudes of politics in the way that Congress is. To take just one small example, we really need states and cities cooperating more than they do. So ideally, what we would have is we would have the federal government saying, you know what? Maryland and Virginia and Washington, D.C., and this is just a hypothetical example, I'm not saying it's happening, you're doing a great job of coordinating your highways and your mass transit and your light rail and all that. We're going to give you more money. New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, you're doing a bad job of that. You're each doing your own things. You don't have any kind of integrated plan. We're not going to give you money.
That would get people's attention.
That would get people's attention, and you can understand why Congress could never do it, right? Because
the
delegations from New York...
Back-scratching here. I mean, this is a big deal, Dave. This is a huge for an economy that's doing something like collapsing, and really for this country's competitiveness for the next, I don't know how many decades.
Yeah, and I think we really do have a chance here, because I think it's great that both Congress and the administration are putting attention on the fact that we need more money. The Congressional Budget Office recently said that they thought there was about $100 billion in annual spending that could productively be done that is not being done now in infrastructure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the push for huge infrastructure spending and what it could, should build, whether we will patch up 20th century infrastructure or build for the 21st. We're going to hear from a couple of top authorities on infrastructure in just a moment. David Leonhardt is with us, economics columnist for the New York Times. Barack Obama has been talking a lot about infrastructure recently. Radio address, weekly radio address, November 21st. Here's President-elect Obama saying his economic recovery plan would include a focus on jobs creation and infrastructure.
We'll put people back to work rebuilding our crumbling roads and bridges, modernizing schools that are failing our children, and building wind farms and solar panels, fuel-efficient cars, and the alternative energy technologies that can free us from our dependence on foreign oil and keep our economy competitive in the years ahead. These aren't just steps to pull ourselves out of this immediate crisis. These are the long-term investments in our economic future that have been ignored for far too long.
Barack Obama, November 21st. David Leonhardt joins us from Washington right now from San Francisco. We're joined by Jonathan David Miller. He is a consultant for the Urban Land Institute and the author of the Institute's Infrastructure 2008 Competitive Advantage Report. Jonathan David Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
And from Washington, Robert Puentes is here, an expert on transportation and infrastructure, a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. Everybody looks to him when it comes to what ought to be built. Robert Puentes, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Robert, first to you. There's the president-elect talking roads, bridges, schools, wind farms, solar panels, and right on down. Are you hearing the right things when it comes to the kind of ingredients for what may be a very large infrastructure push?
I think so, absolutely. The conversation that's coming out of the president-elect and his team about the type of infrastructure that we need is very telling. I mean, he's talking specifically about rebuilding infrastructure, rebuilding roads and bridges, the kind of green infrastructure that'll put us on the path to an environmentally sustainable future and an energy-efficient economy. I think it's critical, though, to make sure that we connect those proposals and the things that he's talking about with everything else that's going on here in Washington. The stimulus proposal that the House passed back in September really wouldn't be very consistent with that agenda. There's a lot of squaring of the circles that we need to do between where I think everybody knows that we need to go and how Washington is currently approaching the issue of infrastructure and infrastructure spending.
Jonathan David Miller, what's your confidence level that if we line up hundreds of billions of dollars to try and jumpstart the economy and aim a lot of that at national infrastructure, that we'll get the right stuff?
Well, you've got to be hopeful. For the first time in a long time, as everybody's been pointing out, we're focused on it, and that's so important because we have neglected it. The first thing we have to do is fix it first. We've got a lot of infrastructure that is old and needs to be repaired and put in good shape. So I think this initial burst can really focus on that, and that could be very helpful. We want to avoid the bridges to nowhere and the pork projects. The bigger issue, though, as you pointed out at the top of the program, is that 21st century vision. You know, in the 19th century, we built canals, and in after World War II, we built this fantastic interstate system. So we need a new vision that integrates roads, mass transit, railways, focuses on our major national and regional centers, because we're going to be adding 100 million new people into our population over the next 30 years or so.
Is that right? 300 million plus another up to 400 million?
Yeah, and people are going to be concentrating in our major metropolitan areas, and we can't continue to be car dependent, and so it's going to change our lifestyles. It's mean we're going to have to pay more to move around, but if we do it right, we'll have more convenient lifestyles and we'll maintain our competitiveness. Mm. So we have to integrate where we live with how we move around. So we need multimodal transport solutions that involve being able to walk to stations, to use the car less, to have high-speed rail in regional corridors, to have high-speed rail between city centers and airports. And it's going to cost some money, but in the end, it'll make us a much more competitive economy, and we'll all do better.
Robert Puentes, I can't help but worry, though. I mean, there's clearly a big opportunity here, but there seems to me to maybe be a tension between this economic need for a stimulus, fast action, get the shovel in the dirt right now and rebuild, versus a kind of green infrastructure for a new century. If we rebuild fast and furious, aren't we likely to just build more of the same kind of 20th century infrastructure that's been fossil fuels dependent, that's the old transportation way? Are we really going to build, you know, fresh, forward-looking infrastructure if we do it quick and dirty?
Yeah, look, I mean, infrastructure investments should be included in the stimulus bill to jumpstart the economy. We've gotten past some of the blockades that have always inhibited infrastructure from being used as stimulus. The unfortunate reality, as David mentioned, is that we're in for a long slog here. So infrastructure does have a role here. But the focus should be on those investments that secure the existing system and help them transition to a clean, efficient, an energy-independent future. We can create millions of green jobs, job opportunities for underemployed families, for all kinds of different things. But we need to, as Jonathan mentioned, think very differently about infrastructure. We still have a system that is rooted in the 1950s. We have not done the hard thing in updating that system to the realities of the 21st century. If we continue to pour money into the existing system, we're not going to get any of the benefits that we talked about. The system is not just broke, it's broken, and we need to recognize that and respond accordingly. It's not just the stimulus that's coming up, you know, in January or whenever it's going to be, but there's all kinds of things on the legislative calendar here in Washington and across the country, energy bill, climate bill, the transportation bill. All these things are coming up in 2009. It would be inconsistent and a very difficult position if the stimulus bill did not send a signal to those other gigantic legislative priorities that this nation is going to think very differently about infrastructure and it's going to put us on the path to a new future.
I want to get into some of the details of what that difference might be, but we've got a lot of suggestions and thoughts from listeners as well. Let's get a call from Sandersville, Georgia, and Hovey. Hovey, you're on the air.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
What I think is sort of missing from this discussion is that we have 135 aged nuclear power plants now that need to be replaced almost immediately just to keep our electrical capacity up to snuff. Then we have new cleaner coal technology coming on, and some of these plants are being held up by various parts of the permitting process.
But that's all private industry stuff right now, Hovey, isn't it?
Private industry, true. We're funded by private money.
Okay.
So this does not require taxpayer input. These people have dollars in hands, and they're ready to invest.
But are you suggesting that a big public spending infrastructure push should get in directly into that kind of energy production business?
In the sense of furthering and fostering the speed up of these permits and allowing industry to do its thing and give us the power we need when we need it, this will put billions of dollars into the economy now.
But isn't that a private investment decision? Or are you saying the Obama administration itself should get the government into it?
Get the government into it so far is speeding up the process.
Got it. So give the green lights and get that going. David Leinhardt, I know we've just got you for another minute here. What about this dance between public and private? A lot of private money on the sidelines right now, credit not really moving, and yet there are big private opportunities in infrastructure as well. Do you see, you know, more permitting, more cooperation? Do you see the government moving in where private industry is not moving today?
I think the most important thing the government can do is get the right framework for private industry. I don't think you want the government making too many fine-grained decisions about precisely what to invest in areas that are traditionally private. But what it can do, first of all, is make sure the financial markets are still functioning so that private companies can actually get loans. But it can also make sure that we have the right set of incentives. And right now, we clearly don't. Right now, we are not building the full cost of carbon use into carbon use. And so if we had something like a carbon tax or cap and trade, the government wouldn't then have to decide which of the various alternative energy things it need to fund.
Mm-hmm.
It would instead be setting up the rules that would make it profitable to get behind these other alternative energy things, which would be better for the planet, and which, again, would be sending less money overseas to countries that are using that money in ways that aren't particularly friendly to this country.
So a big matrix of interests and ways to stimulate them here. David Leinhardt, I know we've got to let you go, but thanks for getting us into this and pointing out some of the big dynamics here. Thanks so much for being with us today,
David. Thanks, Tom. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
David Leinhardt, economics columnist with The New York Times. Let's get a call from Somerville, South Carolina. And Jan, you're on the air.
Yes, I want to make two major points.
Mm-hmm.
One is stimulus package to repair bridges and things like that. I think that's important, but I think what is more important is to start and stimulate new industries, because that way we create new wealth.
Like what?
Well, for example, we know energy is a problem. We ought to be looking to what Europe and China are doing. In Europe, they're taking manure and other waste products and making biogas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a renewable resource we're never going to run out of. And here in the Carolinas, we got big hog farms where we could make enough biogas or natural gas to run our cities here in the southeast.
So not just bridges, but new green initiatives, you're
right,
saying.
But make it simple and cheap. Everybody wants to surcharge every person in this county for a new nuclear power plant and increase our bill by 30%. We don't even want this nuclear power plant. We're going to be charged for it now when it won't even be built 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And we could use biogas or biomass to run, make electricity. The second thing we can do is look at transportation. And what we can do right now is to use some very efficient crops to make ethanol to run our cars on, because that's what Brazil does. And we have crops in the south that will work for that, like sweet potato and sweet sorghum, that'll do 5 to 6 times as much as corn.
Mm-hmm.
And every car in America with a small modification with a flexible fuel chip can run on these fuels. Why do we have to do everything the complicated way? Let's do it some way that will work today instead of hydrogen cars that's 20 years away.
Jan, let us pick those up if we may. Jonathan David Miller, first to you. How does that kind of concern, okay, roads are fine, but let's not just do old infrastructure. Let's get green encouragement going here. How does that intersect with the debate we're in the middle of and are likely to move deeper into, Jonathan?
Well, it's spot on. I think energy, sustainability, infrastructure, they all tie together. And I think it's incumbent on the Obama administration and Congress to start to break down some of the silos between housing, transportation, energy, and put together programs that tie all of these issues together. That's how we're going to provide a 21st century vision. We can't continue to do one-off projects, a road here, a mass transit system here, a windmill over there, a nuclear power plant down the road. We have to tie all of these issues together to get an environment that will really work for us, both in terms of climate and economic competitiveness.
We're looking at big infrastructure issues. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Robert Puentes, how does that happen? How do those silos get broken down? And what's the vision that's going to, you know, set priorities and start getting that money moved out? Jan says, don't make it too complicated, make it simple. Well, who's going to pick up on it? Is there a Robert Moses kind of, you know, big mind out there somewhere in the Obama camp or already in government that's going to oversee this? Is it an infrastructure bank? David Leonhardt mentioned Obama's idea there. Where does this go for steering?
Yeah, it's a great point. We've got to understand where the conversation is today. And when it comes to the stimulus, the focus is on short-term jobs, on making sure that the money gets out very quickly, that it can be spent quickly. And we know that the states are in for a world of hurt, that they're going to spend the money, that they have a whole host of needs. And that is where the focus is right now. I totally agree with the caller that we need to make sure this all sets us up, you know, for the new realities of the future. But the focus right now on the stimulus stuff really is on the short-term jobs. So I think that's where we need to be focusing attention, see what we could do with that money to make sure that there isn't any monkey business and we can keep the mischief down, that we're kind of using it as a signal to these future things and that we're not kind of just doing more of the same. In terms of the silos, again, it's exactly right. I mean, that everybody else in the country, households in South Carolina and everywhere, understand the connections between housing, environment, energy, transportation. These things are fundamentally connected. It's only in the weird siloed world of Washington where these things are separated.
Do we have anybody looking over that whole landscape? Is there any office that is responsible to see it all as one piece? We all understand it is of one piece or needs
to be. The administration has a huge role to play in that. I think there's a lot of optimism and some understanding that this is an area that's going to be undertaken. President-elect Obama, when he was running for office, talked about this issue of a White House Office of Urban or Metropolitan Policy, where some of these issues would be connected. There are folks who are talking about things like an infrastructure czar who would live in the White House and who would coordinate the myriad of programs and policies that deal with infrastructure. Again, we have Department of Housing, we have a Department of Transportation, Department of Energy. Rarely do these things work together. Within transportation, we have a Federal Highway Administration, Federal Transit Administration, Federal Railroad Administration. This is a crazy way to do business. Every other country, industrialized country in the world, looks at this and scratches their head. We really need to get a handle on these silos, make these broader connections, and then talk about how this all connects us to it, to a broader vision for the future.
Jonathan, here we've got a comment from our website, onpointradio.org, a listener saying the U.S. is extremely lucky, all caps, to have one last golden opportunity to repair and update infrastructure. And now, you know, gas prices are down. They're saying we just got a small window here. Do you see this administration lining up in a way that can break through the old log jams and kind of gobbledygook of authorities and commissions and everything else, Jonathan, to get this done?
Well, we've got to hope so, and we've heard all about change, and I think Robert points out infrastructure czar. He points out some of these other departments that we have. We need to think in the 21st century and maybe change how we run our government to address these issues. And it's not only at the federal level. It's at the state level where you have highway departments that don't coordinate with transit authorities, that don't coordinate with counties and villages and towns, everybody doing their own thing. We've got to coordinate all of this, put a national structure in place, a regional structure in place to attack these issues. And it's a bottom-up but a top-down approach. And so the Obama administration really needs to look at changing how we deal with these issues, because we're in a new age where we're falling behind, and if we're going to get back ahead, we're going to have to deal with things differently.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the push for huge infrastructure spending and what it could, should, build, whether we'll patch up the 20th century's infrastructure or build really for the 21st century. Robert Puentes is with us from Washington and the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. He's a professor at Georgetown University's Public Policy Institute. Jonathan David Miller is here, founder of the consulting firm Miller & Ryan. He was author of the big Infrastructure 2008 report from the Urban Land Institute. Lots of talk about infrastructure at the big governor's conference in Philadelphia this week. Montana's governor, Brian Schweitzer, said at a press conference, the public and government should not be lulled by the recent huge drop in gas prices, but should press full speed ahead.
We are going to build an entire new energy system in America, and we're going to create 5 million new jobs. Some say, well, with the price of oil dropping from $100 plus to $50 a barrel, that the imperative is gone. Au contraire, now we have so many more people who are unemployed. This is a great program to build a permanent new energy system, including transportation, and use the people that are currently unemployed to build it.
Montana's governor, Brian Schweitzer there. Imperative gone. Au contraire, he says. Let's get a call from Patrick in Somerville, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I think this is sort of right on point, because one of the major issues is that this country is a first world, one of the most powerful countries in the world.
Mm.
But yet, within the first world, you also have third world and sometimes even second or third world infrastructure. I spent some time over last year in Hong Kong and Singapore.
Yeah.
And their infrastructure is superb. Their train system is absolutely amazing. And even the airport, when we travel from Singapore to Hong Kong and then back to Singapore, and
yeah,
then when we returned to California and then to Boston, it was as if we were shocked.
It's kind of a mind-blowing, isn't it? How sparkling and new and top of the line, and then you're back in ratty subways and crumbling, tumble-down USA.
Absolutely. I mean, my original country is Haiti. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, Haiti is the third world, right? But yet, for this country to be so powerful, it has to be competitive, and the infrastructure has to be number one. And so when you have trains that are sort of running as if it was like the 1950s and 1960s, for the most powerful country in the world, it is absolutely unacceptable. So I think that in order for the U.S., not only militarily, but the U.S. has to be, again, number one, but the infrastructure and education must be. Because Singapore, they were sort of a third world country in the 1940s, 1960s.
No more.
No more, absolutely.
Yeah.
And their buildings, infrastructure is absolutely superb. And now Singapore is lending money, in a sense, to the U.S. So,
right. Watch out. Pull up your socks and let's go, USA. Patrick, thank you for that perspective. Jonathan David Miller, in your big report, you've got some pretty scary headlines. America heads toward decline here. And you're quoting, the United States is scarily behind where an industrial nation should be and loses further ground to competitors. I mean, Patrick's reporting on something very real that we don't often, many people don't think about, because we just live in the midst of this infrastructure and take it for granted as it is.
Well, that's right. You know, I think Americans, I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to tend to be somewhat insular, and we think we're number one, and we've been number one in so many ways for so many years, but no longer in infrastructure, and that speaks to our competitiveness going forward. I'd just like to make a point here, though, about the tie between gas prices and infrastructure. And gas prices could go down to 10 cents a gallon. Our issue here is congestion. And we're going to be gridlocked if we don't do something about this. You know, we're just not going to move anything.
But there's the big question. So, a lot of people don't want to see just another 100,000 lanes with cars burning gas on them. But we're making decisions now.
That's right. And so that's why we have to orient to creating greater convenience for people, you know, transit-oriented development around transit stations and light rail lines and high-speed rail that allows us to stop having to drive to airports and then take short shuttle flights between places like Boston, New York, and Washington, where we can take rail center city to center city that can avoid car and taxi rides and avoid congestion at our airports. Everyone has gotten stuck in airports for long delays. Everybody's gotten stuck in traffic jams. People spend all their time, it seems, shuttling about in suburbs to get around and are totally car dependent. We have to shift to a way to reduce car dependency and to increase our ability to get around easily.
Robert Puentes, but what about that? I mean, we know how to do roads and bridges, though we may not do them in the best order. They may be bridges to nowhere. Even that needs oversight. But how do you get the green factor effectively in here? These plans don't just pop out of the sky overnight. The stimulus is desired. That means speed. But we're talking long-term, 21st century. I mean, even a new national power grid people are talking about. That could change the kind of vehicles on the road. If that power was started at a solar panel farm or a wind farm, is that part of the picture? Are you confident that it will be?
Oh, confident is a difficult word, I think, now. But you're right. I mean, we need a wholesale change in how we're thinking about these things. Over the last 20 years, we managed to construct 132,000 miles of additional roadways in this country. That's enough to circle the globe more than five times. So we're still kind of doing the same old thing as if these new realities weren't present. But here's something interesting. After years and years of steady increases, the total amount of driving in the U.S. has slowed down dramatically, and we're currently witnessing the largest sustained drop in driving that this nation has ever seen. Now, without a doubt, some of this is attributable to the skyrocketing gas prices.
When it was almost $4, or was $4, yeah.
Yeah, but it hasn't bounced back. And that's, mm-hmm. I think, the interesting thing, is that at the same time driving has plummeted, people didn't stop traveling. They just changed how they travel. And we've seen the largest increases, or huge increases, in transit ridership and in Amtrak ridership that we've seen in a long time. It's increased by about 85 million trips over the last year, I think mostly in response to high gas prices. But now that it's dropped back down again, people haven't been going back. So there is something very different that's happening here in the country. And I think it does take a new vision then to connect the realities of today and the issues of congestion we've already talked about to what we want to have done in the future. I mean, this is a huge crisis, but it's also a tremendous opportunity for us to do something very different.
And, of course, it's not just transportation, not at all. Let's get a call from Scott in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an environmental engineer over in Cambridge, right across the river mm-hmm. from you. I'm also a member of ASCE, the Association of the American Society
of Civil Engineers. Yeah.
Right, yeah, and they come out every few years with the Infrastructure Report Card for America.
Mm-hmm.
Last one was in 2005, and the best grade that America got on that was in the aviation sector, and that was a C. The worst was in wastewater treatment infrastructure,
yep.
and those were both at D-. There's actually billions of gallons of raw sewage that's pumped into America's waterways every single year. And if we're going to focus on the green side of everything,
mm-hmm.
I really think it should be, you know, energy is an important part of that. But, you know, what does that mean if there's still raw sewage being pumped into our waterways?
Let us pick it up. Jonathan David Miller, what about the water piece of this and moving water around? Big issues there. Is there enough money to address this whole spectrum, and what do you see happening on the water, wastewater side?
Well, water is another huge issue. You know, there are parts of the country that are running out of water. Atlanta came within a month of running out of water last year.
Yeah.
In the Southwest, in the desert, we're building huge cities, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Utah is expanding. Of course, the whole Southern California area dependent on rather restricted water sources. And so we're going to have, first of all, people, and this cuts across all infrastructure, people are going to have to pay more for water and for sewage treatment. That's just a given. And we're going to have to become much more economic and conservation oriented in terms of how we use water, and this is just about in every part of the country. You know, we're going to be using gray water, water that sort of has been wastewater that we just put into our rivers, as the caller was talking about, and reutilizing that, recycling it into watering lawns and for other sources. And we're going to have to become much more creative about how we use water and treat water, and we're going to have to spend more to do that. But in the end, we will have water supplies, which we take for granted, but which we shouldn't.
if we do the right spending. I want to think about the issue of money and how it gets applied here. I've got a little bit of tape from a Republican governor worrying about the cost of all this spending, saying, be careful. This is South Carolina's governor, Mark Sanford. This is from a PBS NewsHour on Tuesday. Here he's pushing back at the idea of huge public works projects, saying instead of spending our way out of problems, America would end up spending its way into bigger problems down the road. Let's listen.
Well, I'd just say that I think stimulus is well beyond simply printing money and spending money out of Washington, D.C. What we're talking about is borrowing money to, in essence, solve a problem that was created by too much debt. And what we're looking at here is frankly, stacking up so much debt that I begin to worry about the value of the dollar. If we trash the value of the dollar, doesn't matter how many checks we send out of Washington, D.C., we're going to have a much bigger problem with regard to stimulating the overall economy.
South Carolina Governor, Republican Mark Sanford. Robert Puentes, how about it? We're talking very big money here, but we already spend a lot every year on infrastructure, even though we haven't been able to push it to where it needs to be. Mark Sanford worrying there that if we put a great big push in here, it's debt. We can't afford it. It just spirals out of sight.
I don't mind the governor's comments generally. I think that we need to be very careful about all this spending. The system's not just broke, it's broken. We can't afford to just keep pouring more money into a broken system. And the simple equation that infrastructure investments equals economic productivity is far too simplistic mm-hmm. for the dynamic times that we're living in today. You can make the wrong kind of investments and not do anything to address things like household spending. We know that most American families spend more on transportation than they do on food and health care combined. Transportation is the number two household expense right now. If we're not going to make a dent in how much money people are spending on that kind of a piece of their budget, then it does raise real questions. So we do know also that when we look back at the federal investments from the 1970s, we saw a pretty good return on investment, about 18%, followed by a 5% return during the 1980s, followed by a 1% return during the 1990s.
Because they weren't well made in the 80s and 90s, or why? Because they were poorly planned?
Well, we had prioritized investments. I mean, on the federal level, most of this took the form of the interstates. The interstates were essentially finished building by about 1980. These were prioritized investments, whatever you think about them. It was a result of a large national vision.
So that was the earlier that was the good, healthy payoff, as opposed to would you have more boondoggles later?
We haven't had any of that. What we've had is the bridges to nowhere. It just became a kind of a catchphrase to a decision-making process gone wild. I mean, the last transportation bill had 6,000 plus earmarks in it, and I don't think you could say with a straight face that those all aggregate up into a coherent national program. Now, it's not the only problem, the earmarks, as David Leinhardt mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. but it is emblematic of a larger problem, that the programs right now are adrift, and we really need to get a better handle on how the federal government is investing this money. It doesn't have to be top-down. They don't have to choose every project, but there needs to be some kind of framework, some kind of coherent frame for how we're going forward with this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Columbia, South Carolina, speaking of the governor there. And CP, hi, CP, you're on the air.
Thanks. The thing that we've got to decide in this country is that we're going with a total electric economy, not the hydrogen economy or the pig gas economy or anything like that. And once we decide that, then we need to build a mass transit system, if you want to call it mass transit, mm-hmm. to equal what we did with the interstate highway system. And the feature of this is that we've got to fight to buy the right-of-way, and with that right-of-way, then we put the transmission lines to carry the electricity generated by windmills and solar and all like that to right. the places where the people are.
To get the new power grid out there so that people can plug in to green energy carried by electricity.
Right, right. That's the thing that's got to do it. We can't take this green energy off a windmill and get half the value of it by making hydrogen and then shipping hydrogen somewhere. It's got to be electric. That's the clean way to go.
So let's get that grid built, you say. CP, thanks. Jonathan David Miller, do you see the money, the planning, the push for a new national smart power grid in here? Is that part of this, or is that to be left for private investment?
Well, we haven't talked about private investment. Private investment is goes hand in hand with this. And the government, as Robert was talking about, has to set a framework that ties these things together and incents the right behaviors. both from industry and from all of us too. And so, the private funding aspect is going to be very, very important here. But what we all have to remember again is whether it comes from private sources or for government sources, all of us are going to have to pay more for creating the type of infrastructure we really need in this country.
People may be ready to do that if they have confidence that someone's going to orchestrate that and really build it.
You are absolutely right, and that gets back to what good government is all about and what good leadership is all about. And I think all of us have to focus our attention on our government leaders to say that we need an integrated vision coming from our various key government entities to help us get where we need to go.
Robert Puentes, I was reading Bob Herbert, the columnist in the Times, I think last week, said one of the reasons the U.S. is in such deep trouble is that it has stopped being smart, turning its back on excellence, sophistication, and long-term planning. We've lionized dimwits, and now we're paying the price. Do you see the institutions of our government sort of bracing to turn that around? Do you feel the urgency there in Washington, Robert?
I do feel the urgency. I think that what we need to do is a three-pronged strategy, and that the federal government needs to lead in those areas where only the federal government can lead, because these things are national in scope and scale, things that transcend state borders, things like we've already talked about today, around climate, around energy, things that don't respect borders, things like freight movement, mm-hmm. things that are just national in scope. The federal government should focus on these areas.
Yep.
Then they need to empower states and metropolitan areas to be innovative. We've seen so many innovations around this country that we need to encourage smart thinking as opposed to squashing it, which is what we've done so far. So the third thing would just be then to make everybody smarter by having more data and information. It's staggering how much we don't know about how much money is being spent or what the purpose of those spending is.
Well, a lot to keep our eyes on as this big spending package seems likely to rise up and move forward. You've really done a lot to help us do that. Robert Puentes at Brookings Institution and Jonathan David Miller in San Francisco today with the Urban Land Institute's report. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.